Hi guys, here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil, like a lot of it. That's good. Next, I take an ice bath.
Ooh, feeling super healthy. Can't fit my toes.
Breakfast is raw liver.
Okay, here we go. Oh, real good.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time. Signos.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Secrets and Spies presents Espresso Martini with Chris Carr and Matt Fulton.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a sort of special Espresso Martini, because we wanted to look a bit further at the strikes on Iran's nuclear sites that happened almost like 24 hours after, or maybe 48 hours after we recorded our previous episode, and where Trump had left us on a cliffhanger saying, it's going to be 2 weeks before I make my decision, and then lo and behold, he goes and bombs the nuclear facilities.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, that was a lie.
So I felt like we probably should come back and have a bit more of a chat about that. And then in our last section today, we will just talk a little bit about the new official James Bond news, because official James Bond news is quite rare. There's an awful lot of clickbait out there that gets people into a tiz, but this is actually some genuine news, which is quite exciting. So we'll go into that in a bit. So Matt, I'll let you talk us through Iran, because you, as I said before, you're our in-house sort of Iran expert here, so I will hand over to you.
Yeah, thank you. So yeah, I'll get us started here on breaking down. There's a whole lot to talk about here. So after days of Israeli airstrikes on Iranian nuclear and military infrastructure, President Trump authorized the first American combat operation inside the Islamic Republic since 1979. The U.S. bombing campaign, dubbed Operation Midnight Hammer, launched on June 22nd and centered on three sites, Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. B-2 bombers from Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri dropped a dozen 30,000-pound GBU-75 bunker buster bombs, or MOPs, on the deeply buried Cascade Halls at Fordo, while submarine-launched Tomahawk cruise missiles struck Isfahan and Natanz. But in the days since, a growing rift has emerged between the White House's triumphalist rhetoric and the intelligence community's more sobering assessments of what the strikes actually achieved. According to a New York Times report, Trump's decision to strike came after a week of calculated misdirection and internal chaos. While he publicly claimed to be undecided, even telling reporters he'd wait 2 weeks before making any call, the strike plan was already in motion. He authorized the attack from his Bedminster, New Jersey golf club on Friday evening, just hours before B-2 bombers began the 18-hour flight to Iran. The Pentagon built deception into the mission. One group of bombers flew westward over the Pacific as a feint, while the strike package approached from the opposite direction. The operation was timed to avoid tipping off Iran, but also to buy Trump political space. You could back out at the last minute, as he famously did in 2019. This time, though, there was no turning back. Reporting suggests the White House intended this to be a one-off strike, hoping to disable Iran's most hardened enrichment site at Fordo and force Tehran to negotiate from a position of weakness. That night, immediately after the strikes, Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth both claimed the strikes, quote, obliterated Iran's nuclear program, but the truth is more complicated. The Fordo site, buried under a mountain and hundreds of feet of granite and reinforced concrete, was always going to be a tough target. Analysts at the Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA, had warned prior to the attack that multiple waves might be required to ensure total destruction. Instead, 12 MOPs were dropped in a single sortie, targeting ventilation shafts and known service structures above the centrifuge halls. The plan was to channel the blast through the facility's architecture. Early satellite imagery showed no signs of surface subsidence, suggesting the underground halls may not have collapsed. A post-strike technical assessment from the Institute for Science and International Security, drawn from satellite imagery and IAEA data, finds that Iran's enrichment capabilities suffered a massive blow. Natanz, Isfahan, and Fordo all sustained major hits. Conversion facilities, centrifuge halls, and uranium metal processing lines were destroyed. Notably, the uranium conversion facility at Isfahan, a key bottleneck for weaponizing enriched uranium, is likely inoperable for years. IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi said the Fordo centrifuges are, quote, no longer operational, citing their extreme sensitivity to vibration that would have been caused by, you know, a few hundred thousand pounds of explosives coming in on top of them. Still, he stopped short of calling the program wiped out. The DIA's initial battle damage assessment, or BDA, was more restrained, a classified restrike report designed to help commanders determine whether a target needs to be hit again, which leaked to CNN and The Times, concluded the bombing set back Iran's program by only a few months. The underground structures at Fordo and Natanz were not believed to have collapsed, and Iran's uranium stockpiles had likely been moved before the attack. Enrichment could resume quickly at clandestine sites, and officials warned that some nuclear infrastructure might remain intact. The White House dismissed this as, quote, fake news and accused leakers of treason, while CIA Director John Ratcliffe later offered a revised view, stating that the program was, quote, severely damaged and would take years to rebuild. There's also a divergence between U.S. and Israeli assessments. Israeli officials, while stopping short of calling Fordo destroyed, believe the cumulative impact of U.S. and Israeli strikes, including assassinations of nuclear scientists and destruction of centrifuge factories, has severely crippled Iran's ability to produce a bomb. Axios reports Israeli intelligence intercepted communications, suggesting Iran's military is concealing the full extent of the damage from its political leadership. So where does that leave us? Iran's nuclear know-how, its stockpiles, and possibly even more secretive facilities remain intact. And while the cascade halls at Fordo and Natanz and other facilities at Isfahan may be out of commission for now, it's still not clear whether Iran is permanently deterred or more determined than ever. As of now, a ceasefire is in place after Iran launched a token ballistic missile strike against U.S. forces at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. But the intelligence picture is fluid, and Iran's ultimate response over the weeks and months ahead remains uncertain. Whether this was a decisive blow or merely a bloody prelude is a question still waiting for an answer. Chris, what do you think?
Well, I suppose my initial thoughts are the attacks themselves weren't a great surprise. I had a feeling that they were going to happen. The only surprise was when they happened. Mm-hmm. In fact, I actually found out about it from my wife. She mentioned something about some strikes against Iran, and the way she phrased it, I assumed it was Israel. And then when I looked at the news, like half an hour later, it was like,
oh,
America has struck Iran? Oh my God. You know, like talk about delayed reaction.
There. Yeah.
And I don't mean that as a celebratory tone or anything. I mean, I'm personally, I'll put my position out there. I don't think that this was a great idea. And I think in some respects that Trump is making the mistake of breaking international law like Netanyahu has done with his strikes. And there's a whole ethical debate about Yeah, the whole sort of preemptive strike, whether it should be done or not. And there's certainly been debate among American senators who've viewed the intelligence about whether Iran actually posed a threat to America itself, which would allow for preemptive strikes under American law. So there is some very wonky, shaky legal grounds for this attack that probably need to be navigated. Maybe we could talk a bit more about that in a bit. Then the one thing that I will say, I'll give the Trump admin and the Pentagon planners credit for managing to stage an attack of this type with no leaks prior to the mission's execution, which is not an easy feat in this day and age. But it was interesting that the New York Times noted that planners were concerned that Trump was giving away things with statements that he sort of put out there, like when he left the group of seven in Canada to... he basically said that he wasn't leaving to broker a Middle East ceasefire, but something much bigger. And then later telling people to stay tuned.
Yeah, he can't keep his mouth shut.
Yeah. And days before he'd said to people to evacuate Tehran. Maybe there was another plan to actually attack Tehran. And then maybe they decided that wasn't a good idea. I don't know. But it sounds like Trump was the biggest threat to this mission in many respects with his sort of weird tweeting. He wasn't even tweeting, actually. It's Truth Social. What do you call a post on Truth Social? Socialing? I don't know what you call that. Truthing?
I've heard... Someone had a really good joke about... a secretion, or someone called it. Like, it was like a really gross kind of a, yeah.
Secretion sounds about right, yeah. So he actually could have been the biggest danger to the OPSEC of the whole thing. And the Pentagon apparently built in their own deception plan to the attack, which was to send a second group of B-2 bombers that left Missouri and headed west over the Pacific Ocean in a way that flight trackers would be able to monitor that.
Yeah, they said they were going to Guam.
That's it. Yeah, yeah. And then I remember, I think I saw you and some other people would be talking about like the geography of Guam and Whitman Air Force Base and various other things, because the attacks themselves did come from Whitman in the end, didn't they? And it was a 37-hour flight for the B-2 bombers involved directly from Whitman. And, that could not have been, probably was not a lot of fun for the pilots on those planes for being in there for 37 hours.
No.
And I've got some details about that.
Yeah.
We can talk about a bit later. And then just from the UK, I think the mood among a lot of commentators online appears to be sort of fear and cynicism that claims around Iran's nuclear program are kind of a repeat of the 2003 weapons of mass destruction claims, which obviously led the US and its allies to invade Iraq. And there was some fear in those initial days that this could be the beginning of a ground war with Iran, which I think the American administration would like to avoid completely. I haven't seen any signs to say that America
see any signs
is planning to do any actual thing. And even Trump himself has sort of said that this was about targeting the nuclear program, not regime change, even though the Israelis seem to be kind of moving towards regime change. But there's been, again, no real solid signs that that's even happening. But there have now been crackdowns in Iran since then. There's been reports of, I think, something like 700-plus arrests and even executions. So anybody who might be suspected of being a dissident against the Iranian regime, this must be a very bad time, because the Iranian regime that's appeared quite weak and feckless in recent times is really kind of clamping down on things now. And so for ordinary Iranians, that's not going to be good. And it's the thing as well I always find a bit frustrating with the anti-war protests, because I understand why there are anti-war protests and I have some sympathies with them. But I always find it really difficult when certain leftist groups start sort of taking their sympathy one step further and start siding with the Iranian regime and put out slogans and things that kind of make out the Iranian regime are all warm and fuzzy and just misunderstood. There are even people in the Foreign Office who seem to think that Israel and America pose a greater threat to the Middle East than Iran do. I think that's quite... what's the word I want there? I think that's quite a bold claim to say that Israel and Iran are more of a threat to, Israel and America are more of a threat to the Middle East. But, I'll leave that to maybe wiser people to answer that for me. It's these strikes have sort of not really changed much in terms of the hearts and minds that we were talking about last week. I don't think it's won anybody over to be more pro-America or pro-Israel at this time. But I think the people who, do support Israel and, you know, probably think that these strikes are a positive. I can understand wanting to get rid of Iran's nuclear program. I just think dropping bombs on it is possibly not the best way to do it. But, you know, it's easy for me to say that from my flat in London. So, Matt, what are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, I think one can criticize or have justified reservations about the timing and necessity of and strategy behind these strikes without, you know, then resorting to believing that Iran is a, you know, small defenseless being who didn't do nothing bad to nobody ever. That's just not, that's not the case.
No, it's not true. I mean, they've killed British and American soldiers in Iraq for most recent stuff.
So all that aside, I was touching on the legal question real quick around it. I am not nearly an expert on presidential war powers. So to launch a sort of like preemptive strike on a foreign target overseas without congressional authorization or anything, as you said, yeah, there has to be like a clear threat to U.S. personnel interests, you know, that sort of stuff to authorize that, but to you know, allow that. But then there's, you know, define imminent threat is when you then sort of go from that. You know, the intelligence, there's a whole bunch of questions about the intelligence pre-strikes, you know, that the Israelis used to justify it. I mean, as we said on the last one, I think there were rumblings and questions within the Iranian nuclear program, specifically as it came to developing a nuclear warhead that could be put on top of a ballistic missile, that came to the forefront after the collapse of Bashar al-Assad's regime and Hezbollah, and that probably gave the Israelis, that was sort of what they needed to, you know, justify doing this. I think well-intentioned, intelligent, reasonable people could, you know, can disagree on whether or not that was enough, and whether that posed an imminent threat to the U.S. You know, yeah, that's all worthy of debate. But I think as far as, you know, like, does this violate international law? Did he have the authority to do this? I don't think anything's going to come of that question. You know, like, he's not going to be impeached over this. Whether he should or not is a different question. Please don't yell at me, listeners. But, you know, he's not going to be impeached over this. So it's sort of like an academic argument.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. Impeachment for me has sort of lost its effectiveness anyway. It feels like a certificate you just get printed out and says, oh, you've been impeached and fuck all happens.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of, yeah. Okay. And then what? And then even if it succeeds, okay, you get Vance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Matt, obviously you've been monitoring this. So do you want to talk us through sort of what is known about the strikes and sort of where they sit with the kind of with the Israeli campaign that's been kind of going on for days prior to the U.S. intervention?
So the thought there, the thinking, I mean, this is sort of an operation, a scenario that has in some way been kind of planned and thought about and discussed in think tanks and academic circles, to say nothing of within, you know, U.S. and Israeli defense establishments and the intelligence communities for, you know, 20 years. As the joke goes, Bibi's said that Iran's been a couple months away from building a nuclear weapon for 20 years, and that is true. Part of that discussion has always been that, you know, if the Israelis started a campaign against the Iranian nuclear program, and I think before they got F-35s, you know, stealth fighters, it was questionable if they would have been capable of doing this. I think they're getting F-35s, having a stealth attack capability, and also the collapse of the Assad regime opening up Syrian airspace are the two kind of key things that made this technically possible for them. I mean, there have been rumors for years that, like, I don't know this for a fact, but again, a rumor that, you know, the Israelis had, say, like a sort of classified agreement with the government of Azerbaijan to use airfields in their country as sort of like a staging ground for strikes on the nuclear program, right? Before the F-35s, and they would have had, you know, the capability to strike directly from Israel, right? So that that discussion has been had been ongoing for years as to how they, if they could pull this off, like how would they do it? I think one sort of central conclusion from that was that they could start it, but they couldn't end it, right? And that was also probably a thinking of the Israelis, is that, well, if we start it, we're going to force whatever U.S. administration was in office. You know, you could say Obama, Trump 1, Biden, now Trump 2, you know, they would have had to come in and clean up the mess that we started. I think, I don't know that I hold this view myself, but I think there is an intelligent and useful argument to be made that once these strikes began, it would have been, you know, okay, we never should have gotten here in the first place. Incredibly dangerous. We sort of known that and have talked about this for, you know, 20 years. But okay, we're here now, for better or for worse. We're here now. This is happening. You know, what are the best decisions that we can make in the moment? And I think there is a intelligent, credible argument there to be made that, you know, okay, once these strikes began, it would have necessitated our involvement, because you can't, it would be more dangerous to leave the job half done than to, you know, let it, you know. So there's that.
Yeah.
The debate that we're sort of having here now about, you know, the intelligence assessment post-strike and everything, and a lot of this, the news cycle here in the U.S. for the last week or so has been driven by the CNN and New York Times reports about a preliminary intelligence assessment out of DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, that it was assessed with, you know, low confidence that that the nuclear program had only been set back by a couple months and strikes had not been fully able to destroy the Cascade Halls at Fordo.
Mm.
So there's something to be said there about that assessment. So when intelligence agencies disagree all the time, U.S. intelligence agencies disagree with each other all the time, I think that's good that we have, you know, thorough, rigorous academic debate and discussion within the intelligence communities, right? And in a way, that's sort of part of what the Office of the Director of National Intelligence is meant for, and the National Intelligence Council, is to sort of navigate those debates between the various agencies and everything and try to bring it all together and come to some kind of a consensus, right, to then present to Congress and policymakers, you know, military leaders. Within the U.S. intelligence community, assessments and estimates are supported by information that vary in scope all the time, quality and also sourcing all the time. Consequently, when you see their, you know, assessments on something, right, issue X, in this case, it's whether or not Fordo was, you know, obliterated, we'll say, which obliterated is not a term that the intelligence community or military leaders would use. They're far more sterile and cautious in their language. But that's another issue.
Well, it's a bit vague and grand, isn't it? The obliterated.
Yeah, it's sort of it's meant for TV and chest thumping, which is where we are. But so consequently, they'll ascribe high, moderate, or low levels of confidence to their assessments. And low confidence generally means that the information's credibility and or plausibility is questionable, or that the information is too fragmented or poorly corroborated to make solid analytical inferences, or that we have significant concerns or problems with the sources. So that sort of, when DIA comes out and says, we assess with low confidence that Fordo was entirely destroyed, that the Cascade Halls were collapsed and everything, when they judge it with low confidence, they're saying, we don't really know for sure, because the information that we're drawing this from is scattered and incomplete, and it's been less than 24 hours at the time this assessment was made, less than 24 hours following this strike. Again, I think, you know, on the Saturday, that night of the attacks, and then going into Sunday, I had a bunch of people reaching out to me, you know, friends and stuff, like asking me about the strikes and everything, if you were like, am I going to be drafted? I'm like, no, you're not going to be drafted. Like, go back to bed. I'll let you know if you need to worry about being drafted, but we're not anywhere near there. Like, please don't,
yeah,
please
midday,
don't do that
cool them up.
Yeah. Please don't do that to yourself. It's really not necessary. So, you know, I just that night, like, I think, yeah, before the B2s even got back to Missouri, they didn't get back until Sunday. It was during the day at some point.
Well, yeah, it was a 37-hour mission, so it's a significant amount of time.
Yeah, 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 let's get into that next. But so they, when Trump came out and said right after and said, you know, these sites were entirely obliterated, I mean, I said to people they were getting a hold of me that night and into Sunday and everything, there is no possible way that he can possibly know that. I mean, yes, even the president with the entire, you know, military and the intelligence community at his sort of fingertips, you cannot possibly know, you know, before the sun had even come up over Fordo, could not have possibly have known that. That was his sort of
mistake.
his desire to manufacture a quote, you know, perfect war for the TV cameras, right? To I think, settle the nerves of some of his sort of non-interventionist MAGA base, you know, that like, this is a one and done, or this is it, like, boom, we go in, strikes in, out, 20-minute adventure, you know, no more bombs after this. I think it was sort of born from that, and also to show that, you know, him to just immediately declare mission accomplished, and to use that language as obliterated is reckless and irresponsible. Yeah, you could not have possibly have known that night. I mean, so when the intelligence community does BDA or battle damage assessments, I don't know. So this intelligence assessment that we're talking about came out of DIA. They have a, under their directorate for analysis, they have a center. It's called the Underground Facility Analysis Center. I haven't seen their name tied to this assessment. Just my sort of like educated guess is it would have come from them. I mean, these people that are study the wonky term is HDBT or hard and deeply buried targets, and the Underground Facilities Analysis Center, they do that 24/7, study that 24/7. Underground, you know, command centers, nuclear facilities in, say, Iran, Russia, China, North Korea, elsewhere as they pop up. There's also an outfit under the DTRA, the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, which is not part of the intelligence community. It's a service agency under the DOD. They have an outfit called the Hard Target Research and Analysis Center, or HATRAC. They're sort of referred to.
Mm-mm.
But when they go back and they do that BDA, that battle damage assessment, right? And then it gets pulled into the rest of the intelligence community. And, you know, okay, so they're looking at satellite imagery. They would be looking at infrared imagery of the sites around Fordo, probably radar imagery from satellites and also reconnaissance aircraft drones.
Do you think any seismic surveillance as well? Because I'm imagining if you managed to blow up an underground facility, there's going to be some sort of rumblings that could be detected somehow.
Yeah, so the seismic data, that would probably also, just sort of my gut kind of understanding, educated guess here, would come through AFTAC, which is the Air Force Technical Applications Center. They're headquartered down in Florida, and their job is to do a lot of monitoring treaty compliance around non-proliferation regimes and nuclear weapons and everything. They have a global network of seismic monitoring stations.
Mm.
So yeah, how much, I mean, so that would have been like, they would have, their job is to detect like if the Iranians tried to clandestinely conduct an underground nuclear test or something, right? So those seismic sensors would have picked that up and they would get data on that. I would imagine with the amount of ordnance that was dropped on Fordo and Natanz, that it definitely would have registered something if they could then take that data and try to, you know, work backwards and come to a conclusion of, okay, based on all of this, yeah, we think the extent of the damage is going to be this severe. I mean, there's also, and this was some of the reporting that the Israelis are doing this right now, too, they would, you know, listen for signals intercepts of Iranian personnel, military officials, scientific officials, you know, talking amongst each other about the damage at Fordo and Natanz, Isfahan, the extent to which the uranium, highly enriched uranium stockpile would have been compromised or not, right? So we would listen for stuff like that. Also keep in mind, the Iranians could get on the phone and say a bunch of bullshit because they know that we're listening, you know? So you have to also then take that into account and try to cross-reference those assertions with other sources and methods, right? Human sources on the ground that the U.S. or the Israelis could have, you know, that you would get word from them to say, you know, yeah, I talked to someone who was at Fordo the other day, and he says, you know, these tunnels are collapsed or whatever, and this is how badly it's been set back. All that stuff takes time to come together, which goes back to my point that for Trump and Hegseth to say that, you know, that night that it was totally obliterated, you can't possibly know that.
Yeah, well, this is it. I think the Trump administration need to learn or should learn lessons about moderating the early proclamations about things and allow proper assessments to take time. I think a responsible president should go on television and say that we've done this and we are now waiting for confirmation how effective it's been. There's nothing wrong with that. But because Trump is all built around this sort of weird idea of masculinity and everything's got to be perfect, it kind of feeds into this stupidity that then, you know, his early claims might be inaccurate or they might be accurate. And the problem is, critics of Trump and his actions will always believe any early assessment and see later ones as politically motivated.
Right.
And Trump just doesn't help himself. Is my constant criticism of Trump is he is his own worst enemy, because this could well have been the most historic, effective, devastating, whatever, you know, language you want to use, strike against any Iranian site in the history of mankind. But with the way Trump sort of handles all these things, it kind of just ends up becoming a right old mess.
Yeah, he really can't get out of his own way. I mean, this is such a self-inflicted own. And I mean, I think if there's, I mean, we'll probably talk about this more over the course of the episode, but if there's any sort of like, if there's anything that I think listeners should go away with the belief on, you know, the question of, okay, did these strikes work or not? I think we have to, I think right now, the news cycle and a lot of the discussion around this, around that DIA assessment and, you know, the obliterated word, I think we're getting sort of wrapped around the axle in a very kind of dumb beltway media argument. Yes, Trump and Hegseth were very irresponsible with their words, and they should know better and should not have done that. If you notice, Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, even at that same press conference where Hegseth used that word obliterated, even I believe Saturday night and Sunday morning when they held another one, did not say that. He said, you know, the BDA is still essentially, the BDA is still, we're still working on it. We don't know yet. We're looking at it. We're putting that together. That's the correct answer. That's what a professional would say in that setting, right? But I think, you know, the question of how far back has a nuclear program been put, you know, there's some other analysis from the ISIS think tank, the good ISIS.
It made me chuckle.
That looks at, I mean, they were around long before the terrorist group ISIS. And I remember at the time in like 2014, it was like, oh, shit, is ISIS going to have to change its name now? I have a family member who had a dog named
Archer
ISIS.
Archer had to do it, awkward, didn't
they? But a lot of their assessments and everything shows that there is real serious and lasting damage to the Iranian nuclear program. I think it's a mistake to sort of hyper-focus on the U.S. strike on Fordo and what those MOPs did. I think we need to take a more holistic look at the Israelis, the week of Israeli strikes beforehand, the U.S. strikes, also any sort of offensive cyber operations that may have happened over the course of this that we are yet unaware of. Special forces operations, which I believe just yesterday that I was on Blue Sky over the course of the war and saying like I would watch out for Israeli special operations raids targeting that uranium stockpile, you know, like going on the ground and getting it and taking it out of Iran. Like a heist, essentially.
But there's plenty of photos of it being picked up. So I'm imagining you could track the trucks, where they're going, etc. And I'm sure the Israelis know what's going on.
Right. I mean, that's the other thing, too. Like, you know, we just speaking of the U.S. intelligence community, we probably would have had regular regular eyes on those nuclear sites, probably at least from October 7th. And then once the Israeli strikes happened, 24/7, like unblinking stare on those sites, anything that came or went out of them, we were watching. And that probably definitely factored into the strike plan. Right. But, you know, going back to, I think we need to look at all of this in a sort of cumulative way. The U.S. strikes, the Israeli strikes, any sort of cyber operations that we're unaware of, special forces, Israeli special forces operations on the ground that we may be unaware of. Also, the dozens of Iranian nuclear scientists that have been assassinated over the course of this operation. Also, whatever the Israelis may or may not do in the future. Yes, I know there's a ceasefire in place right now. I don't think we're going to have Israeli airstrikes again, at least in the near future, but that doesn't mean Mossad won't keep doing what Mossad does behind the scenes.
Do you know, it was interesting when Trump first announced those, the ceasefire, and he was, because he was just heading off to this NATO conference, and I think he was trying to do a victory lap of, hey, I've just bombed this thing, and hey, I've got a ceasefire. And then immediately Israel violated it, and I've never seen Trump use, was it the F word he used against?
Yeah, he said Israel and Iran have been fighting each other for so long that they have no idea what the fuck they're doing, which I think is a bit of, and then he like immediately just like stomped off to his helicopter. I think there's probably a bit of projection there. But you know, yeah, it's definitely says something. I mean, I think if a president dropped an F-bomb in front of the press on live television, previous times, it would have been a really big deal. But this
mean, like the tan suit affair, probably.
Yeah. God, exactly. Can you imagine what Fox said if Obama came out and dropped an F-bomb on live television? Yeah. Holy mother of God. But, you know, I mean, you can make that comparison for about five things that happen every single day now.
Yeah.
What if Obama did that? But no, I think the more sort of responsible idea and probably correct one is it's been set back somewhere between a couple months to a couple years. I think there has been real damage. Is it, you know, are they going to be able to recoup, or are the Iranians going to be able to recoup from that damage? I mean, eventually, you know. But there's also the question of what then comes from these strikes. You know, there's just starting yesterday, there were rumblings sort of coming up that the U.S. is trying to sort of restart negotiations for an actual nuclear deal, which is what you would need to ultimately shut down Iran's path to a nuclear weapon. You cannot do it by force, not the price to you. I mean, you could do it by force, but the price to do so is not anything anyone is willing to pay. That is, you would need troops on the ground to do that. You can't do it from the air without any sort of blood loss on our side. It's not possible. So you do need a diplomatic resolution to this, right? And there's reporting now that they're sort of talking about unfreezing about, I think it was like $6 billion in Iranian funds and sort of helping them construct an actual civilian weapons, power program that would be under, you know, IAEA monitoring and everything. I don't know quite where that goes. You know, there's something about Israeli counterterrorism operations in Gaza pre October 7th, Israeli counterterror operations in Gaza and the West Bank to an extent. You know, they would like routinely every so years, let's say, right, they would sort of come in with, you know, airstrikes or special operations raids and just sort of keep the Palestinian militant presence in Gaza or the West Bank from getting, you know, too powerful, too out of control, right? The Israelis would call that mowing the grass. And of course, you know, there's the implication then that the civilian populations that are caught up in these operations are just sort of weeds that need to be, you know, once in a while cut down. And, you know, I leave that there for people to make of that assertion what they will. However, I think it's true that once you do something that's really difficult for the first time, it becomes infinitely easier to then usually becomes infinitely easier to do it again. And I think there's, going forward in the months and years ahead, there's a chance that that's also what we see of between Israel and Iran. You know, will there be a sort of mowing of the grass once in a while that the Israeli Air Force feels it needs to undertake against the Iranians, right? I mean, so they're, the Iranian air defenses have been shattered. I'm really curious to see if they get Russian or Chinese help to try to rebuild that. You know, will the Israelis allow them to do that? I mean, these are all open questions that we just don't really have the answer to right now. It's too early to tell. But again, I go back to, if there's one thing I want listeners to take away from this is, you know, yeah, Trump and Hegseth were irresponsible and got way ahead of their skis and coming out and saying that it was, you know, quote, obliterated and this is done. And now trying to sort of pummel the press corps and intelligence agencies into submission to sort of warp reality to what they want it to be. That's a big concern. However, I think the more likely outcome of these strikes as a whole, U.S. Israeli strikes and covert action as a whole, the Iranian nuclear program has been seriously battered, somewhere between a couple months to a few years setback. I don't know what within that range. However, it will take some sort of a diplomatic solution to fully take an Iranian nuclear weapon off the table. The monster is not dead yet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the report you shared with me from the Institute for Science and International Security, which is the good ISIS, yes, that we mentioned earlier. So they actually, it felt like, because they looked at the whole picture, including U.S. strikes.
That'll be linked in the show notes. It's a really good report. I highly encourage listeners to go read it.
It is. And it feels like, in fact, the whole, the Israeli Operation Rising Lion and Operation Midnight Hammer, the American one, actually have together dealt a devastating blow to Iran's nuclear program. And so in that regard, it does seem to have achieved its objectives. Now,
right,
the idea of it, the US doing a one and done, and whether they've actually completely obliterated Fordo is another question entirely. But
yeah,
it certainly feels like they've done significant damage to it. I wouldn't rule out personally whether the US will want to do this, but I suspect that they might feel they might need to do a repeat mission if they find intelligence to suggest that Fordo still could be salvaged. But
right,
I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
That's also another really interesting question. I mean, in the discussion in the lead up to the strikes, right, at least, you know, in the public spaces that I'm, you know, listening to and everything, there was always sort of the assumption that it would not be a one and done mission, right? That you would need to take a couple swings at Fordo to fully knock it out, right? And I mean, that could very well have been what the intelligence community and the Pentagon told the White House. And they were like, nope, we want to do a one and done. We want to have a perfect war and that's it. And I mean, so that's, you know, that's okay, you know, that's that. It's true that, yeah, that they just didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
There's also then, you know, okay, the question of will we do another round of strikes on Fordo? I think the timeline for that has passed. You know, Trump seems pretty set on
so moving on from it.
Trump seems pretty set on declaring victory and moving on from this. I think if there was a window for a second strike, that would have come sometime between Saturday night and, you know,
yeah,
Tuesday. I don't think he would have rushed to declare a ceasefire. I think he probably unilaterally just declared a ceasefire and then sort of forced everyone to go along with it is sort of my read of it. But, you know, I think he got spooked by the poll numbers on this, which are putrid for him. And also he got spooked at the chances that Iran would close the Strait of Hormuz, which would ratchet up gas prices everywhere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Also in the U.S. during peak summer travel season, which isn't fun or popular. I think he got spooked by that and sort of reinforced his idea that this needs to be a one and done thing. I think the sort of status quo that we have arrived at right now, that would have to break down before we see another strike on Fordo. There's also the question of, you know, 14 MOPs were used in this operation, 12 on Fordo, 2 on Natanz, right? The public number that I've seen as to how many of these weapons we have was 20. I also think it's also also probably certain that the real number of our stockpile is not going to be publicly available. I'm like almost 99.9% sure that that true number is classified. However, I think it's probably true that we don't have tons of these weapons to just throw around, you know?
Well, they're very specialist and expensive, aren't they? So you're not going to build a lot of them.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing too, you know? So this weapon was, the MOP was sort of designed to strike Fordo specifically, you know? I mean, this, like when we were talking last week and everything, and I said, you know, the Pentagon and CENTCOM are very much insistent that they could do this thing. My thinking was that that target, Fordo, has been a, that's been a target that people, that there are people in the intelligence community and in the Pentagon and CENTCOM who their job, like they get paid to obsess and think about nothing but that single facility and how would we destroy it if the time ever came to do that. And in a way, you know, the GBU-57, that MOP was designed to destroy that facility. So, I mean, I think also if you look at some of the test footage, I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here. If you look at on the test footage of that that Dan Kane put out in a press conference yesterday, it was a test of the MOP at the Capitol Peak test bed at White Sands. Really cool. It actually overlooks the Trinity site. You know, that explosion did not collapse the tunnel that it was tested in. It destroyed everything in, anything in that tunnel would have been destroyed, but it did not collapse, cave in the roof of that tunnel. So again, I go back to, if we're sort of obsessing over the word obliterated and whether or not the cascade halls at Fordo were collapsed or not, I think we're sort of focusing on the trees and missing the forest here.
Yeah, totally, totally. One other thing just to add, there was a really good piece you shared from Lawyers, Guns, and Money that was talking about how...
It's by Cheryl Rofer, a blog post there. Yeah. She worked at Los Alamos for many years.
Oh, did she? Did she? Yeah, yeah. And it talks a little bit about like how the Iranians use sort of concrete and stone in sort of layers to help divert sort of blasts and shockwaves from any bombings. And so, you know, not only is it deep down, but obviously rocks and things can actually weaken the effects of the blast the further down you go. So it's very interesting.
It's like a strata. It's like a layer cake.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So it's that side of things is very interesting. One other question, there's two other questions I'll ask you about all this. So what are your thoughts on the Iranian retaliation that happened against the U.S. base in Qatar? And how is that, you know, it doesn't seem to have escalated things.
No.
But what are your thoughts on all that?
It was symbolic. It was a token strike. I mean, all air assets had been evacuated out of Al-Udeid a long time before, a few days or at least a week before these strikes happened. I think it was before the Israeli strikes happened, we started evacuating stuff out of that base. It was coordinated between the U.S. and the Iranians, like what time we're going to do this, and also Qatar. It was a very staged, orchestrated, symbolic response. I think they fired six or seven missiles at the airfield, which would match the number of B-2s that were used to strike the nuclear facilities. They had to do something, but that day, like I was watching, you know, the Patriot interceptors try to fend these strikes off, and I said, you know, if that's all it is, they're not interested in taking this further.
Yeah. The Warzone have quite a good piece about the Patriot batteries that were used to defend the base.
I'll put that in the show notes.
And apparently there were 44 American soldiers who were responsible for defending the entire base. And the oldest soldier was a 28-year-old captain, and the youngest was a 21-year-old private, only been in the military for less than 2 years. And the Pentagon is saying that, you know, they believe that this was the single largest Patriot engagement in U.S. military history. So
also, biggest B-2 strike in history.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And, well, one would hope it stays that way. So one other question as well is, how is Trump now sort of doing politically for all of this? Because obviously when we spoke last week, there's the isolationist wing of the want to say the conservatives now, sorry, of the Republicans. Yeah. So there's an isolationist side of Republicans, which are kind of married to MAGA, the Make America Great Again movement. And then you kind of got what we're talking about, the neocon side of things, are a bit more interventionist, maybe sort of George Bushy kind of view on the world. So how is Trump sort of doing? So you mentioned some polls earlier, you know, what's going on your side of things?
The polls on this are really bad. I mean, while it is broadly understood and agreed upon here that Iran should never have a nuclear weapon, the idea that, you know, we should have done these strikes to stop it, it's not popular, like across the board. There's been a big effort by them since this to sort of warp the discussion into, you know, if you question our strategy behind these strikes or the lack thereof, that you also then hate the troops, which I think is just really kind of gross.
I saw that. Very George Bushy.
Yeah.
Freedom fries. You know?
George Bushy, but also dumber. You know, in a way, you know, I mean, so those men and women of the 509th Bomb Wing that flew the B-2s that were part of this strike. I mean, so those pilots and their enablers in the operations, maintenance and mission support groups, I mean, their job in this is to get those bombers into Iranian airspace undetected, drop their ordnance on time, on targets, at the aim points that they've been given to sort of set the fuses appropriately to do what the planners at the Pentagon and CENTCOM in the intelligence community said they should do to destroy the facility and then get out undetected. And they did that. They did their job. Whether or not the plan that they were given and meant to execute as derived was capable of achieving a broader strategic objective is not their concern. You know, so to say that to use them as human shields, I think is just really gross. No one's saying that those pilots didn't do their jobs. They did do their jobs exactly. As they were meant to, that there was no strategy behind it, or that the strategy was half baked and poorly considered, is way above their pay grade. It's not what they do. It's not their job.
And Trump's post that could have endangered the whole thing as well, you know, or weakened the effectiveness of it.
Yeah.
You know, that could be considered unpatriotic. And
yeah.
If you really want to get into that.
Yeah. So that's what I think about that. Dear. I mean, yeah, this is nothing to do with just to criticize the strikes and the effectiveness of them is to say nothing of that those pilots and their enablers, their support personnel on the ground did not do their job flawlessly. By all accounts, they did. Whether the strategy behind it was achievable or sensible is another matter. It is not their concern. No.
Any thoughts on the kind of brewing MAGA civil war that seems to be happening at the moment over this? Because Tucker Carlson.
I don't know if there'll be much of a civil war. I think a whole lot of people got sort of bullied into submission to sort of find their way around to. I think if this went further into, you know, sustained round of airstrikes and really escalated, you would have more problems. But this really kind of, at least militarily for us, really seems to be done for the foreseeable future. Whether something good or bad comes from that, I don't know. But militarily for us, this seems to be done for now. And because of that, I don't, I mean, there was a real schism within his base for sure over this. I don't see it really going much farther than it has, just because it is kind of done.
It kind of, all of this reminded me a bit of the Moab episode of 2017, where Trump dropped the biggest bomb, biggest conventional bomb on an ISIS base.
That was in Afghanistan,
It was, yeah, and it killed like 36 ISIS fighters, and it very symbolically, obviously, the bomb is the biggest one in the US arsenal before kind of going nuclear. Mm-hmm. And it just felt, again, like it's sort of like I'm a tough guy kind of move, symbolically.
I could make some jokes, but I won't.
Fair enough.
As to what I think the reasoning behind that. Dr. Freud may have some ideas. But.
Indeed, indeed. Well, Matt, jokes aside, is there anything else you'd like to add on Iran, or are you happy?
No. If any folks have any questions or anything that they would like to ask about, please get in touch with me however you can. If I am able to answer it and it's not classified, I'm happy to do so. We're going to have more discussions about this with some other folks going forward next month. I won't say who yet because I don't like saying it before they're recorded because things happen.
Well, no, exactly. Things happen.
Yeah. But
in the world of podcasting, anything can happen.
We'll talk more about this. And if anyone wants to, you know, ask me about it or talk about it, I'm happy to do so. Get in touch.
Cool. Thank you for that. Well, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with more.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, can something this small throw my body off balance?
Time to consult the online experts. One bite will destroy your metabolism. Drink butter coffee instead to kill
insulin
cravings.
Sensitivity.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Signos.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
So welcome back, everybody. So our final piece is some, worlds away from Iran. It's actually hopefully some exciting new news. So this is official news about the new James Bond movie that's been in development hell, I suppose, for a while. We've had everything from regime change to, you know, all sorts of things have been going on behind the scenes of the new Bond movie.
How long does a project have to be stalled before it's considered to be in development hell? Is there like a scientific measure of that, or is it just sort of vibes?
I don't know. That's a very good question. Sometimes development hell means it can be
decades.
I mean, there's been some films
years.
That have been, 20 years. I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head, but there are some. I mean, one of them that didn't end well was a sci-fi film, and I'm trying to remember the name of it now. And it basically, the source material was used by lots of other sci-fi movies. So by the time it came out, it kind of felt a bit sort of dated and been seen before. John Carter's the film I'm thinking of. Not a good film, but the source material has inspired so much sci-fi that we know well.
Bankrupted the producers, I think, right?
It did, yeah. And a similar thing happened to Dune as well, which eventually got brought back to life via Denis Villeneuve. In the interpretation now that's considered the best version of it. You had the David Lynch film that ended very badly, and the studio messed around with it a lot without his permission.
What was the name of the director who wanted to do the other Dune adaptation that there was like storyboards and all kinds of concept art drawn up and then it never happened?
Yeah, Alejandro. Yeah.
Alejandro Jodorowsky. Yeah, he had a Dune adaptation there was all kinds of stuff made for it and it just never got off the ground. We're sort of getting away from Bond, though.
Yes, indeed, we are. But there is a connection because Denis Villeneuve, who directed the new Dune, is now going to direct the new James Bond film. It was confirmed by Amazon MGM Studios that Villeneuve will direct with Amy Pascal and David Heyman as producers, which is, I think, fantastic news. I think, actually, In many respects, Denis Villeneuve is probably the best director out there to handle this, in my opinion. I think it's really hard because it depends on the tone they're going for. But before I go into my thoughts, Matt, what are your thoughts on this news?
I mean, I know when we had the discussion about this, when it was announced that the Broccolis were leaving and Amazon had sort of fully executed their coup, shall we say, that I had big misgivings. I did not really have a lot of reason to trust Amazon. I was just sort of I did not like how it seemed to have gone down with the Broccolis being essentially kind of forced out of what was really, yeah. I mean, their kind of family business, you know?
It felt like a very corporate maneuver, didn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it did not inspire confidence. And something I said at the time was, you know, it could be bad. It could be good. We got to wait and see what they do with it. And as far as, you know, picking Denis Villeneuve to do this personally, I got no complaints. This is great. I'm really eager to see who the writer is and, of course, who is picked to play Bond. But beyond that, like, cool. I hope they get out of his way and let him do what he wants.
Yeah. Well, James Bond now be Timothy Chalamet.
Wouldn't that cause riots over there if we had an American actor?
Well, we've been close to it. It was... James Brolin was the closest American actors of becoming James Bond, as far as I know, because he was going to replace Roger Moore for Your Eyes Only, and then Roger Moore came back. So there's actually some footage of James Brolin as James Bond on YouTube where you can watch him do the scene from Russia with Love that all Bond actors are supposed to do as their audition. And I'll be honest, I wasn't feeling it. I like James Brolin as an actor, but as James Bond, not quite. It's hard.
I have a feeling it's going to be, and this is, I mean, there's so much clickbait about who's going to be the next Bond. It has been for years, and it's all kind of nonsensical. And a few people have quite literally aged out over the course of this speculation. I think, you know, it's going to be an actor from the British Isles, dark hair, kind of late 20s, early to mid 30s, and a few credits under his belt, but not a household name.
Well, this is it. Yeah, because the part of the reason they like that is, number one, they want an actor who can show that they can act and they've done so successfully. Then they want somebody who's not going to cost them the earth, because that's why you won't hire Henry Cavill or somebody really well established, because
Tom
it's
Hardy.
Just too expensive for that first movie. And then those are kind of the two key things really that probably motivate that early thing. And then they want somebody who's sort of in their 30s, as Michael G. Wilson put it before he was deposed, that's going to stay with the franchise for about 10 years. And so when you look at, like, Daniel Craig fit the profile you've just described, except for he had lighter hair, and there was a whole hair gate over Daniel Craig, but oh God!
I took a blonde Bond in outrage. I took great offense to that. I was like, "The fuck? We can be? What do you mean, blonde guys can't be Bond? What do you mean?"
Roger Moore had kind of fairish hair, you know. So we will see. But no, I think Denis Villeneuve is the sort of choice I would like, because I think his films, are going to be more atmospheric. There'll be, you know, I think there'll be stylish thrillers that will feel grounded. I think you won't have any of the whimsical nonsense that led to, like, Die Another Day, which was the final Pierce Brosnan film, which I thought was bad. Then it'd be interesting to see how they tonally shift away from Daniel Craig, because Daniel Craig's Bond was quite introspective, but and stylish in places, definitely. I liked a lot of the movies. I think, yeah, I've said this before, I think, like, I actually quite like No Time to Die. I always thought it was his second strongest film, because Casino Royale for me was a knockout the park Bond movie. A lot of people who don't even like James Bond liked that film. It just did something, and they never managed to match it, sadly. There was something about Lightning in the Bottle, that particular movie, that worked so well that they never quite caught.
Yeah, they got screwed by that writer's strike that came when they were doing Quantum of Solace and everything, which probably lost their momentum.
Well, I think they lost confidence. I think Quantum was going in that... I always liked Quantum of Solace. It's an imperfect movie, but it was kind of going in... It had that youthful Bond thing that they set up in Casino Royale, which then they completely ditched with Skyfall, made him like this has-been middle-aged guy. And like it just, I mean, it was interesting for drama, but I think Skyfall in a way became a bit of a step backwards and then pushed them down this road where you started getting to more Bond tropes again. And for me, I think for me, the biggest, so with the whole Broccoli, Eon Broccoli business, like, was it a good thing to have got rid of them or not? One of the things, there were warning signs, I think, early on about, I felt that Eon were running out of steam with the franchise mm-hmm. a little bit. You know, you had long periods between the movies, and then you had Spectre, which I felt was a very derivative movie. It felt like the writers had just sat with the James Bond DVD box set and literally picked out scenes from other movies and then recontextualized them into Spectre.
Fed a bunch of old scripts to ChatGPT. Yeah. I mean, ChatGPT wasn't around at this time, but
it was... unless they had the experimental
right,
model.
Yeah, yeah. MI6 had an experimental ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Fed it all and said make a Bond script is sort of what it... I mean, it was a shame, too, that they sort of... I mean, I thought the potential of having Blofeld as like a big bad had a lot of potential and could have been really cool. I think Christoph Waltz was like perfect for that role, for a modern iteration of that. And it just feels like they kind of did not execute on it well.
No, and I think the mistake with Sam Mendes, he tried to take James Bond into a slightly superhero direction because of the success of Marvel movies. And I think it led to some very questionable choices, like Blofeld being James Bond's half-brother. Even my problem with Skyfall, as much as I enjoyed it when I watched it, my biggest problem is I find Silver, the villain, a bit too comic booky, and there's too much contrived stuff with Silver's master plan to get captured by Bond that really, to me, on repeated viewing, just like, I'd usually just switch it off by the time Silver gets there. Because it's just, for me, the first half of the movie works quite well until Bond meets Silver, and then it all rapidly goes downhill.
Right.
Not that I think Javier Bardem's an amazing actor. I just think some poor choices were made, I think, with his character, in my opinion. I'm sure there'll be people out there who think this is sacrilegious. I apologize. It's just my thoughts on it. And then obviously No Time to Die has been the most divisive Bond film among Bond fans. I have no idea about people who casually watch James Bond, but the amount of pieces I see online almost on a daily basis where No Time to Die comes up and somebody says, it's the worst Bond movie ever made and blah, blah, blah. And I think the problem is killing James Bond. Again, the killing of James Bond at the end of No Time to Die did feel a bit like spaghetti being thrown at the wall by Eon and not sure what to do next.
Well, I think they wanted finality to that.
Yes.
And I think Craig really wanted that.
Oh, he apparently insisted on it from day one. Yeah. I don't know the full ins and outs of this, but it's been reported that maybe it was, I think it was after they did Casino Royale, there's some reporting that he and Barbara Broccoli were like, I don't know, in a car somewhere and talked about this, and Craig expressed this desire to kill Bond off at the end of his run. And I think what they should have done what they did at the end of other Bourne movies, where you think Bourne's dead and then suddenly you see him silhouette in the water and he just slightly moves.
Or like the Dark Knight Rises.
Put it at the end of the credits. Yeah. It would have given people some hope, and then it would have totally bypassed it would have kept all the emotion and the moving. And also it happens in If You Only Live Twice, where James Bond is, assumed dead and he loses his memory, and then he comes back in The Man with the Golden Gun, if you go with the books.
Right.
And he's lost his memory, and then he tries to assassinate M and all sorts of stuff. So it's not like this is completely out of the realm of James Bond.
No.
But,
I am overall, I still want to see who's writer and who's hired to play Bond himself. But I mean, as far as like, you know, decisions that would inspire confidence by Amazon, I think hiring Denis Villeneuve is great. Love it.
Yeah. And you may even see Roger Deakins come back as cinematographer.
Ooh, good point. Good point.
Who's the
DP for the Bond for the Dune films? His name is
Isn't it Roger Deakins? I thought Roger
Deakins.
No,
it wasn't Deakins.
Did the first one.
It wasn't Deakins.
I thought Deakins did the first one.
Greg Fraser is Dune Part 2. Yeah. He did Greg Fraser did both Dunes.
Ah, cool. Yeah. So it could be him.
Deakins did Blade Runner. Denis Villeneuve's Blade Runner.
Yes, he did. And that was, I really, Denis Villeneuve's films, I like them all pretty much. I'm a big fan of Arrival. I think it's my favorite of his.
Yeah.
Really love Prisoners. Sicario. Let's not forget Sicario, which is a brilliant movie in many ways. I have issues with some of the story, but it's a very stylish movie. And yeah,
I'm curious what this means for the timing of Dune Messiah.
Well, apparently Dune Messiah is happening before Bond. So I think what it is, Bond will probably come out in 2027.
We got a little ways to go.
Because they're busy. They're about to start shooting Dune, the new Dune, in the summer. That's due out, I think, next year. So I suspect, you know, a lot of directors, you know, in the lucky position, they kind of like go from one movie to another, and it kind of happens. So he'll be doing pre-production work probably on Bond as he.
Yeah, they'll be doing the script and everything while they're shooting Dune and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because they still got to hire a writer and stuff. So I suspect that, you know, he'll be working on this when he's in post-production on the new Dune movie slip into the new film. So,
I would be curious if we would get John Spates, I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name, or Eric Roth, who did the screenplays for Dune, would be sort of most sort of logical partnership to reach for Bond. I could see that.
Yeah, I can imagine it. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they do, because I think, you know, there's been many a problem with the Bond movies for some time. And so I think, as we were saying earlier, obviously the corporate takeover, as it felt like, of the Bond franchise didn't leave much to be desired. But now seeing what we're seeing, I'm excited. I'm hoping this will be a fresh start, and you never know. Denis may pull off the most memorable Bond film yet. We'll see. Yeah. We will see. Fingers crossed.
He may do it.
Yeah.
He may.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Matt, thank you very much for your time today. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up? Or
No. This was a good discussion. We'll see how everything with Iran goes. It's going to be you're going to need some sort of a diplomatic resolution to fully settle this question, and whether that is achievable or not is we'll have to see.
Yeah, time will tell where this will go. People are still squabbling over the assessments at the moment, so we'll see where we go from there. Well, thank you very much, Matt. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we will catch you next week. So take care for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's. Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only. Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from PodSave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, PodSave the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a 1-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from PodSave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.